Here we go with fourth down and 9. Risky looking deep down the near side. He overshot it. Waldron with his third interception of the game. Ducks inside the 5 at the 3. It seals this win for the Division I East All-Stars with 5 seconds remaining. What a game today from Ryan Waldron, the Madison safety, with his third interception of the day and wrapping this one up for the East.
And that interception tied an 8-man All-Star Game record as Ryan Waldron of Madison with 3 interceptions, 1 at the very beginning of the game, 1 at the end to seal it. That was the 8-man Division I All-Star Game on Saturday afternoon as the East Division I winning 35-34 over the West All-Stars. That was the second game. The first game was a classic as well, 36-28 in favor of the West after they trailed 14-0 and 22-8. So we'll jump right into this one. We'll get to the Royals coming up. Also, a former Chief saying he'll never play for Andy Reid again. A tennis star continues to add to his legacy over the weekend at the French Open. The Bucks have new lease on life in the NBA playoffs. We called that, by the way. We'll tell you about it in a little bit. And the Suns sweep the Nuggets. Chris Paul, the ageless wonder, getting it done. MVP thrown out of that game in the NHL playoffs. We begin with the 8-man All-Star games from over the weekend. The 8-man Division II game was the first game that was on the books. The morning game, we did not have 8-man All-Star games a year ago because of COVID-19, so we were excited about the games. Didn't know how the matchups would turn out. You always are hoping for really close games. Spoke with Kevin Ayers of Little River, assistant coach for the D1 East, after the game before a post-game interview, and him and I both agreed that usually you get one good game and one not-so-good game. Rarely do you have two great games, and we had two fantastic games, and man, oh man, was it something. The first game, we'll start there, Division II All-Stars, a lot of our local players in that game, and it all got started very early in the contest with a connection between two Twin Valley League members.
Second down and 5 at the 32 for Division II East. Two receivers left, one receiver right. Juneman rolls the near side, throws from the near hash mark, airs it out deep down the field, flag on the play, the ball is cut by Mitchell Busiamaxto, and he high steps it into the end zone for the touchdown. A 48-yard touchdown strike from Juneman to Boosing, Hanover to Axtell.
So the East jumped out to their early lead. They got the 2-point conversion, led 8-0. And on their next possession, it was Juneman to Juneman on a swing pass on 3rd and long.
So 3rd down and 14 officially from the 20.5-yard line. And the gun is Juneman. It's a swing pass to Collins. Wow. He has a lot of room to the near side. 30, 35, midfield, 40. Stays inside the boundary. 20, 15, 10. Near sideline and in for the Division II East touchdown. It's a 59-yard touch pass on the swing from Juneman to Juneman. Jacob to Collins for the score.
It was 14-0 at that point, and the East All-Stars really didn't do a ton after that first quarter offensively. They had some big plays. There's another big one we'll get to, which set a new 8-man All-Star game record. But the West, their defense kept a minute despite their offense sputtering, moving the ball, but not able to cash in when they had golden opportunities. And it was their defense that got them on the board for the first time during the day and really changed the complexion of the game.
3rd and 14 for the East. And a pass is picked off at the 20. On the return is Schreiber, and he is in for the touchdown. The West with a pick six with 5:52 to go in the third. Down 14-0. They needed a huge play from their defense. Clayton Schreiber jumps the route from Stafford and returns it for the touchdown.
So the West are back in the ballgame at 14-8. They'd go down 22-8. They'd come back, tie the game at 22-all, a 52-yard touchdown pass for Colton McCarty of Shylin to St. Francis's Shadron Blanca. We're all tied up at 22. And then it was the defense again for the West, scoring their second touchdown of the second half to take the lead for the first time of the day.
Second down and 10 from their own 4 for the East to our right. It's a pitch to Juneman! And the ball is fumbled. It's recovered by the West for the touchdown. With the recovery is Trevor Zarbenicki of Wheatland Grinnell. But it was Jesse Baxter of St. Francis as they ran a pitch from Jacob Juneman, the quarterback, to Colin Juneman. He was wrapped up immediately by Baxter. It was close to being a safety. And then Juneman fumbled the ball. And it was recovered by Zarbenicki. And the West has taken the lead on their second defensive touchdown of the day, 28-22 with 4:45 to go in the fourth quarter.
And it looked like the West, that was going to be the game-winning score. It looked like it. Fourth down and 9 for the East, 2:39 to go in the ball game at their own 9. Fourth down and 12, nothing going their way. And then suddenly lightning struck.
Fourth down and 12, the East will go for it under 3 minutes to go at their own 9. Don't convert this, probably ball game. Jacob Judiman does have some time. He goes deep down the field for Colin Judiman, jumps up and catches it, stays on his feet at the 37, near sideline 30, 20, 10, 5, Colin Judiman is in, a 71-yard touchdown catch on fourth down and 12 with 2:39 to go. The East, very close to being extinguished, now suddenly they have tied the ball game on the throw from Judiman to Judiman.
Don't make that play. The East probably done, and they lose probably 28-22 or worse because they would turn it over at their own 9. Instead, the 8-man All-Star Game record, that is the longest pass from scrimmage in an 8-man All-Star Game in 36 years, 71-yard pass. Keep in mind, 8-man All-Star Games, 8-man games, of course, are 80-yard fields. For those of you listening that don't understand the 8-man game very much or haven't been to games, we'll try to help educate you because it was an adjustment for me the first time I ever did an 8-man game. The 40 is midfield. There is no 50-yard line. It's 80-yard field. So that's a 71-yard touchdown pass. That's an 8-man All-Star Game record from Hanover's Jacob Judiman to Colin Judiman, the Hanover connection there. And that tied at 28, two-point conversion failed. But the West came right back down the field. A 50-yard pass ended up being a 50-yard pass play. It was really a 5-yard pass that turned into a 50-yard catch and run. And that set up the West. And a few plays later, they were able to score the game-winning touchdown with 59 seconds remaining from a 6-man player.
McCarty under center. He keeps it from Shai Lin, running left, trying to give the West the lead. And he's in! He's able to plow his way into the end zone. And the West has taken the lead, 34-28, with 59 seconds to play on the 2-yard bulldozer run by Colton McCarty.
Colton, six-man McCarty, they call him. He was quarterback of the six-man state champion Shai Lin Cougars, and he got it done there on that play. Two-point conversion was good, and the West led 36-28. East had one last chance, had a third and one, and was sacked for a loss. Then they had a fourth and forever, and it was incomplete. And the D2 West rallies from 14-point deficits, 14-0 and 22-8, to get the win by a final of 36-28. It was a fantastic game, and the West was able to come through. So the East leads the all-time series now 12-8. And just a couple of more nuggets before we move to the next game. The West scored 28 of their 36 points in the fourth quarter, all 36 of their points in the second half, 28 of 36 in the fourth quarter. That ties an 8-man All-Star Game record for most points in a quarter held by Division I West teams in 2002 and 2013. And now in 2021, a D2 West can have claim to that record as well. Top stat guys, Jacob Judiman of Hanover throwing the football 16 of 23 for 268, three touchdowns, two interceptions he threw in the game. And Colton McCarty of the West from Shai Lin, 12 of 16 for 182 and a touchdown. Colin Judiman of Hanover, 9 catches, 187 yards, and 2 touchdown receptions. And Mitchell Boosing, a catch for 48 yards and a touchdown to start the score. And Cooper Wolf of South Haven, 3 catches for 75 yards. And Shadron Blanca, 3 catches for 70 and a touchdown as well. Not a lot of rushing yardage for either team. Jacob Judiman, the quarterback, had a 13-yard touchdown run as well. As the East falls to the West, the D2 game, the morning game on Saturday, by a final of 36-28. So that was a really good game. That was a great game. It was a great game. And we talked about it as we headed into the second game of the day on our 8-man All-Star Game Radio Network. What about the next game? Because you got some big shoes to fill here. This is a pretty good opening act to follow. And the D1 game, Dusty, in the afternoon actually might have even been better.
Yeah, it was an outstanding game. And you know, we're looking to have another great game. And then right off the bat, the East gets their first possession. The West actually had their first possession. And Ryan Wolgram of Madison got his first interception the day after the West had taken it all the way down inside the East 10. And then the East took their first offensive possession. And it only took them one play to make themselves known on offense.
So
Ryan Wolgram with the interception in the end zone. The East takes over first and 10. Jaden Garrison playing quarterback from Little River. The shotgun snap. He had a lot of rushing yards this season, and he takes one on the first play down the near sideline of the 40. 35-30, 25-20. Tight roping the sideline. 10-5. Touchdown. Jaden Garrison from Little River gets the East on the board on the first play from scrimmage for their offense. It's a 65-yard touchdown run for Garrison, and the East leads it 6-0 with 8:16 to play in the first quarter.
So we had less than a minute later, the West had the ball again, but the second drive ended with another interception by Wolgram. It was set up at the West 17. The East needed just three plays to extend their lead. Garrison ran another one in from 12 yards out to put them up 12-0. And then undeterred, though, the West regrouped. They'd score on two straight possessions of their own. Wichita County quarterback Cade Ritzke scored from 11 yards out, cut the East lead to 12-6. They would recover their onside kick right after that. And then Ritzke was able to find the end zone again, this time from 2 yards away on the final play of the first quarter to tie the game at 12. So that's how the first quarter ended, back-and-forth game. But the East would come back in the second quarter and get things rolling early. Just 16 seconds into the second quarter, the East had the lead back as Clifton Clyde quarterback Aiden Rudolph answered with a 65-yard touchdown run of his own. Following what his teammate Garrison had done in the first quarter, the East went up 18-12 on that touchdown run. And then on the next West possession, Hunter Engel of Madison registered the third takeaway of the game. He intercepted a shovel pass in the backfield and set up at their own 31-yard line. Garrison found a wide-open Owen Eidman from Chase County for a 49-yard touchdown pass on the first play of the drive, and that extended the East lead to 24-12. But the West regrouped again before halftime. A 29-yard touchdown pass from Ritzke to South Gray's Aaron Skidmore, laying out in the end zone to make an outstanding play. And then Ritzke and Trace Tassett connected on a two-point conversion to cut the East lead to 24-20. It was the first successful two-point attempt that we saw the entire day up to that point. The East would take that four-point lead into the locker room at halftime. And then they opened the second half on an eight-play, 67-yard drive, ending with a 3-yard touchdown run by Garrison. Rudolph added the two-point run to put the East up 32-20. And again, Rudolph made a play defensively to set up the East at the West 21, but they weren't able to get a first down in a very rare occurrence in eight-man football as they faced a fourth down at the West 10. The East decided to kick a field goal and put themselves up by 15, make it a little bit more tougher for the West to get back into it if they could make it. And Little River's Graham Stevens just calmly booted a 27-yard field goal attempt through and gave the East a 35-20 lead. And really, in the end, that would be the difference in the game. The West did trail 35-20 and found Harlan Obioha on a fourth and goal pass from the 3 to get back within 35-28 after an all-important two-point conversion run by Cade Ritzke. And then the West would recover the ensuing onside kick, but Eli Campbell of Sedan got an interception. The East went 3-and-out, though. West took the drive 53 yards in just 7 plays and capped it off with a big touchdown there to get within 1.
We're down to 3:05 to play in the game, 35-28, second and goal at the 3 for the West All-Stars, looking to get within 1 and possibly take the lead with a two-pointer after that. The shotgun snap goes to Cyrus Green, bowling his way into the end zone for the touchdown from 3 yards out on the direct snap to Cyrus Green. His first carry of the ball game, and that's a good way to have your first carry, a 3-yard touchdown run to get the West within a point at 35-34.
Had the chance to take the lead on a two-point conversion, kind of a discombobulated play, and the pop pass attempt by Isaac Salmons of Hodgman County fell incomplete, and that preserved a one-point advantage for the East. On the final drive for the East squad, they faced a 4th-and-1 from their own 36, and they decided to go for the win.
They have Aiden Rudolph in at quarterback, with Garrison split to the far side. Hunter Engel to the right hip of Rudolph. 1 minute to play, 4th down and 1.5 yards. They take the snap. Rudolph keeps, powers his way forward off of a tackle. He's not going to get it. He's stopped. Brody McDowell, Lucas Webster are in on the stop for the West on 4th down and 1 yard. It's a loss of 0.5 yard for Aiden Rudolph when he got popped. And a turnover on downs will give it back to the West, trailing by 1 with 55 seconds remaining.
So the West wasn't done. They did have one final opportunity and had a 4th down play to try to keep themselves alive.
Here we go with 4th down and 9. Risky looking deep down the near side. He overshot it. Waldron with his third interception of the game. Ducks inside the five at the three. It seals this win for the Division I East All-Stars with 5 seconds remaining. What a game today from Ryan Waldron, the Madison safety, with his third interception of the day and wrapping this one up for the East.
So Ryan Wolgram wrapping it up there, and I actually saw Ryan after the game. I said, you're definitely the defensive player of the game today for your squad. He's like, we'll see. I was like, I don't know if we're going to see. I think he pretty well wrapped it up with 3 interceptions, an 8-man record. So Wolgram outstanding defensively in the contest, finishing with those 3 picks, a single-game record, as Wade said earlier, in the 8-man All-Star game. Garrison was outstanding offensively for the D1 East. He finished with 172 yards rushing, 21 carries, 3 touchdowns. We mentioned the Aiden Rudolph 65-yard touchdown as well. And then Cade Ritzke of Wichita County had a great day offensively, numbers-wise, for the West, 21 of 32, 209 yards passing for 2 touchdowns, and also ran 33 times for 102 yards and 2 scores. So great afternoon there for Ritzke, but his team fell just a point short there in the end. And as far as total offense was concerned, 387 for the West, 351 for the East. Most of the East came on the ground, as we mentioned, 270 compared to 81 passing, and then 178 on the ground for the West, 209 passing yards, a pretty balanced offense. But really the turnovers were the biggest issue, obviously, for the West, with 6 giveaways on the day and 4 interceptions by the East defense. So it was a great day for both teams, and the East made that one last defensive play to seal the win and go home with the victory there on Saturday.
All right, I understand the official statistician of this game was Sam Myers. I need you to call Sam Myers. I need to get the final the official statistics that he has, especially on defense. Because this was one of the easiest, I mean, there was tons of offensive plays. There was lots of plays, okay? Mm-hmm. There were lots of great defensive plays in both games. You just mentioned Ryan Wolgram. It's a no-brainer. He has to be defensive player of the game. He had 3 interceptions, ties an 8-man All-Star game record, had the first one to set the tone, had the last one to seal the deal. That, to me, is a no-brainer. Jacob Klipp of Hanover had 1,833 tackles in the first game. And Clover knows I'm close on that one if Todd's listening.
Yeah.
I mean, we called it. We almost got
I was down on the sideline. I saw it right with my own eyes real close. And, yeah.
We were almost embarrassed because it seemed like and I said embarrassed because it was like it was a broken record. You want to describe it differently. Mention other kids. But it was Klipp over. And Boley of Axtell was in on a ton of tackles, too. And then you had Eberle, Lance Kaiser of Osborne, Eberle of Lakeside got involved in some big plays, too. You know, Perez Twins did a nice job in secondary as well for the East. But, man, I tell you what, the Klipp kid, and then Ethan Benny of Pike Valley did a really good job up front in the middle too. But the Klipp and the Volley kids, man, they were like all over the place. But especially Klipp, who's an all-state linebacker, and the 3 Hanover kids, there's a reason they win state titles, man. They won state titles in football, basketball, and track and field this year.
Tell me
they just swept everything.
Tell me they're not just offensive guys that put up numbers. They actually can tackle, too, and that's how they win state championships.
Well, Klipp can even kick.
Yeah, he
Klipp
can.
Hit a 52-yard punt that just landed and died from his own goal line. I mean, Jacob Klipp was the defensive player of the game, without question, in the first game. And Volley was a close second, I would say. And there is no doubt Wolgram was a defensive player in the second game. In regards to offensive players, that would be a little bit more difficult.
Yeah,
I think Garrison was the kid in the second game that was probably the offensive player of the game if I had to pick. In the first game, I don't know. That's a little bit tougher. I would probably say, you know, I would probably say Colin Juneman because he had, you know, he had a 59-yard touchdown reception, 71-yard, 187 yards catching the football out of the backfield. So I guess he would be there. McCarty had a solid game from Shai Lynn. So anyway, a little bit harder on the offensive side, but the defensive side was about as clear cut as you possibly could ever make it out to be, because I want to know how many tackles. I'm telling you, get a hold of Sam Myers. Putting a pressure on Dusty here. Get a hold of Sam Myers. I want to know how many tackles Klipp and Volley had, both of them, but Klipp in particular, because I believe that he had to have been close, if not set an 8-man All-Star game record for tackles, because it seems like we mentioned his name about 50,000 times.
Yeah.
He was really good.
I'll shoot Sam an email later today and see if he can send me that info, if he's got it gathered up and ready to go yet.
Because our offensive statistics are pretty close usually to what other people have, but the defense, we don't have time to to accumulate the tackles. We get, you know, fumble recoveries and, you know, things like that and interceptions. But, man, he was impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great day.
Yeah, Garrison and Ritzky really had command of both of their
both
offenses. And so I would say co-athletes of the game there. Ritzky made a couple mistakes, you know, with throwing the ball. But there's a reason why Little River and Wichita County were in the state championship. When you see guys like that that have command of everything that's going on, make mostly smart decisions. Right. Garrison was very, very smart. You could tell that just watching him practice all week and actually interviewing him when I did. You could tell that he had a really good head on his shoulders. And I'm not saying that Cade Ritzky didn't. I just didn't have the opportunity to sit down and one-on-one and talk with him. But you could tell why those two particular teams were playing for a state championship in 8-man Division I in the fall. I mean, they had really smart and athletic and gifted quarterbacks that led their team. And a guy like Graham Stevens who stepped aside – as a junior, so Garrison could come in and play quarterback for Little River, and just they were able to develop camaraderie there at Little River. You could see that real quick when I talked to all of them. And Kevin Ayers is great.
He's one of the best 8-man coaches of all time. In
state
the state
championships,
of Kansas. Titles
four
in three
places.
Yeah,
four, three different places. Three different four places. Total titles.
Right. What he's done there, and then Graham Stevens hitting the field goal that really, as I accurately point out in the post game, extra point. But. I don't expect field goals in 8-man games.
Exactly.
I was thinking extra point because it was 1 point difference. So I was thinking
extra
point. But that was a 12-point game made at 15. But that was that kick was good from about 40 yards.
Yeah.
And Kevin Ayers said after the game, I asked him, I said, did you, is that something you guys used during the season? Or he goes, we should have used him. Sometimes we went for two and it worked, but there were times where we should have used him and kicked it more often. But he was a regular starter, so we didn't know about, maybe taking a chance of him getting kicked, getting run into, his plant foot or something. But he boomed that field goal with ease. He would have had the 8-man All-Star game record if the ball was placed further back, because the record's 30-yard field goal, and he had a 27-yarder. So he didn't break the record there. But if he had another opportunity, he could have easily done it. And that was really good. The long snap and the hold and the kick were all very, very solid. But it's interesting. Little River, Wichita County, Hanover, St. Francis, all those guys had big-time players. The Baxter kid from St. Francis made maybe the biggest defensive play on the hit and forcing the fumble in the end zone that gave the West the lead, 28-22. And then Blanca had a 52-yard touchdown catch in the game down the middle, and he's going to be going to the Shrine Bowl. And then you talk about Hanover and all the contributions those three players made, and you mentioned Little River and Wichita County. It is true that when those state championship players, those guys that make it state title game, they usually have a huge impact on the 8-man All-Star games, and rightfully so. So it was a great day. Harlan Obioha, dude, he set a record for the tallest offensive lineman 8-man All-Star game history.
I don't even have to bother to look that up.
6'11". Nicest kid you'll ever meet. He's choosing basketball, and we talked to him on the sideline. Very nice guy, and it was interesting talking to him about the advantages and disadvantages of being 6'11".
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have time to get into trying to get the right clothes and the right size of shoes and how long the bed is and hitting your head on the doorway overhang, things like that. Because it is interesting. My son's short. My oldest son's short, and he says, I'm short. It is what it is, Mm-hmm. And you look at our family. My wife's short. I'm 5'10". That's like about average, I think. My son's probably 5'7", my oldest, and he might get to 5'10", 5'11". He probably won't get to 6 feet, but who knows? Maybe he will. But we've talked about there's advantages and disadvantages to being short. There's advantages and disadvantages to being tall. And usually what happens is short people want to be tall, and tall people want to be shorter. And it is interesting because I've talked with people that are tall, and you don't understand the challenges we have as tall people. Mm-hmm. First of all, getting clothes, laying in a bed, laying on a couch. I mean, they're not. This stuff isn't made for 7 feet tall people. And Harlan Obioha is 6'11". So it is interesting. There was a 6'5" guy on the floor on the field, Huggins, a wide receiver, and he looked small. And he was normally would have been the tallest guy in either game.
So
it was really interesting. And another thing I want to throw out there before we move on with the 8-man All-Star games into the Royals and NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs.
I want to say something too.
Sure.
If you don't say what I'm about to say,
no problem. But what I thought was that we didn't have any ejections. We didn't have any horrible, bad things happening on the field. And one of the things I saw in the second game, and I'm sure you probably saw it in the first game, was I saw Harlan Obioha take down a guy, level a guy, and immediately help him up to his feet.
Yeah.
And as soon as the game – in fact, the game wasn't even over yet. After the interception of Wolgram, if 5 seconds left. They had to take a victory formation knee. There are players from the East that are already coming over to the West to give them hugs, shake hands. I saw Engel come over to Obioha right away. Obioha, at one point in time, had to go to a knee during a timeout. He was completely winded and dehydrated, probably because it was a humid, sticky day, needed some water. But those guys left it out on the field. But everybody, I mean, we didn't have any problems with these kids.
No.
I mean, these kids were class acts on both sides, all four teams. The coaches talked about it. They picked up everything so quickly. And I do think there was something, and you alluded to it at the end of the broadcast, and I'm sure you want to extend upon that, is that not having a game or games last year, and it was nice to see, you know, Cooper Brown, by the way, won our free small blizzard today because I asked him what's one of the four primary colors of the jerseys that they're worn at the eight-man All-Star games. Well, of course, Cooper knew all four. That was easy. But he would have played in this game last year. He didn't get to because of COVID-19, which really sucks. I mean, there's lots of things that stunk about and people missing things. I know there's bigger things than eight-man All-Star games, but it's a bummer, man. You work so hard, you get this recognition, and then it's got to be bittersweet for those kids to be there and get recognized at halftime, but at the same time go, man, I never got to play, and these kids are getting to play a year later, and the year before they got to play, but then I didn't get to play. It is unfortunate. Same thing applies for teams that were close to winning state titles in basketball, and you know, and then watching teams win state titles this past year, saying, what if? And it is tough, and I know it's tough for those kids, but it was nice they would get recognized, the kids that could make it back that were on the teams last year that didn't get to play. But I think the not having a year of the games, I think, was not lost on the players this year, and certainly the coaches and many people that were involved this year.
Yeah, so actually there's two things I want to say about it, because I do want to expand upon that a little bit. And it was, and I put this on Twitter, I said it on the post game, and people didn't hear that or see that. At the banquet Friday night, that blue Division I East team came through the line at the head table and thanked every person up there, shook their hands. All 20 players did that on their own, because I know their coaches weren't really even around them saying, hey, go thank those guys.
Right.
They did that on their own, and it kind of prompted the other teams to do the same. Almost all 80 players. There was a couple maybe that maybe weren't in the room anymore that didn't see it by the end of it. But it left an impression on me, and it left an impression of great kids that I had seen all week anyway that were all about not only learning and wanting to play the game of football, but also have those relationships. But like I said in the post game, and you just alluded to, I think that they knew that in their mind, that they were here for their teammates from last year too. And they were here to make sure that they could enjoy this experience that their teammates didn't get to enjoy last year. And I really felt like I saw that pretty much all week. And it was just a great group of kids. And like I said on Twitter in the post game, the parents and coaches and anybody that's had a hand in raising and teaching them kids and bringing them up should be very, very proud of those kids and of themselves for everything that they did with this group, because they were great. Another thing that I wanted to touch upon was when you were talking to Harlan Obioha, it's kind of a callback to what we were talking about last week. I could hear it in his voice. Remember when we were talking about all the pressure that's on people last week and having to make decisions and people ask questions, why isn't this kid doing this in college? Mm. Why isn't this kid going here to do something here? Why isn't this kid doing this? I could hear it in his voice when he was explaining his decision for next year, because 6'11", he's an outstanding basketball player. Mm-hmm. He's an outstanding football player. Has over 25 D1 offers. He mentioned by name Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of people asking him why he's not playing D1 football if he has 25 offers.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear it in his voice. Mm-hmm. And my heart broke for the kid, because he's a great kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
To have to go through all that pressure.
Sure.
And then make the decision that I'm 6'11 and very athletic and I'm going to play basketball, and that's a bad decision.
Right.
It's basically how it came off when he's like, I'm playing basketball. And then he did say, I'm happy to have that out of the way to be able to make that decision. I'm going to play basketball.
Well, I asked him,
I said,
isn't it a burden off of your shoulders?
Yes, exactly.
Because I know how it is.
And it just took me right back to last week, what we were talking about on the show, about all these people that are talking from the outside that are saying he should do this, he should do this. Mm-hmm. And we don't understand that it's the kid's decision to do what he wants to do. And he made that decision to go play basketball. I'm sure there are a lot of disappointed Division I football coaches that he is not playing college football.
Mm-hmm.
Lane Kiffin might be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still his decision, and I'm glad he was able to actually put that out publicly on our broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever else he wants to do that, he can do that. And it struck me from what we were talking about last week, because it was just perfectly in line of what we were talking about. And And he made that decision, and we wish him the best of luck no matter what he decided to do.
And had he chosen not to do any athletics, which I think he was even considering
that. Yeah, exactly.
Power to him. He needs to do what he needs to do. You know, I have people that I've talked to on the sideline before that have, over the years, eight-man All-Star games that have said, you know, can you believe this kid ain't playing football on the next level? I'm like, my response is, it is a 12-month-a-year job.
Yeah.
It isn't even, it's not, it's a sport, but it's a job. I mean, you're on a scholarship, but, you know, in a way, it's almost like they own you. You have a scholarship, but you know what? We're giving the scholarship because we expect you to play football or basketball or baseball, whatever the sport may be. People have, so many people out there, and many that are listening now, may not have any idea the work that it takes to be a Division I or Division II or any college-level athlete. It's not easy no matter what level it is. There's more scrutiny, of course, at the D1 level, but, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, I'm looking. First of all, I had to look way up when I was looking at Harlan because he's 6'11", I'm 5'10". But, he did. He, like, right away, you could just almost – and I know it. I've talked to another kid that's 6'5", that's an outstanding player in the state of Kansas in 4A in basketball, and he had a lot of offers, not as many as typical because of the transfer portal in college basketball and everything else. So it would have been kind of a – he's going to go to a college in Colorado to play and learn. He knows exactly what he wants to do, so forth and so on. He kind of could have gone to other places, but he said, you know what, there's a lot of BS, and you have to read through it. And he said, there's only a couple places where I felt they were genuine. And that's the key, because all of these guys, like I guarantee you, Harlan mentioned Lane Kiffin. So apparently Lane Kiffin stood out, and he liked Lane Kiffin. But, you know, you talked about 25 Division I offers. I will guarantee you that Harlan didn't feel very comfortable with some of those, as would any kid, because you can tell they're feeding you a bunch of horse pucky. Because they're politicians. Coaches have to turn into politicians when they recruit. Some will promise you the moon and the stars, and they're lying through their teeth. Some of them will be honest with you and say, listen, I think you can play here. I think you got a great chance, but you're going to have to earn it. And there's a different way of recruiting, different way that coaches go about it. And we're not talking just the head coaches. They got the assistant coaches on the recruiting trail. You got alums that are trying to pull at you and talk about this or that, or former players that say, hey, you know, can you get a hold of this kid? Because we really would like him to play at Alabama or K-State or Oklahoma, wherever it might be. And people have no idea the pressure, because when I talk to this kid, that's his dad is a friend of mine, and I talked with him at a traveling basketball tournament in Kansas City about a month ago, and I said, I bet you're relieved. He said, you have no idea. He goes, you have no idea. He goes, for two full years, I have been getting phone calls, I've been getting texts, I've been getting letters, I've been getting emails, and it is overwhelming. And think about this. I'm 45. That would be overwhelming to me. But then these kids are 16, 17, 18 years of age, getting all of this attention, which is great. I mean, and once again, and in fact, I think Harlan said this, it's a blessing and a curse.
That's exactly what he said.
It's a blessing and a curse. Now, I remember him saying those words. It's a blessing and a curse. And it's kind of like what I talk about. You want to be tall, 6'11", it's a blessing and a curse. You barely can get behind the wheel. How can you get behind in a car? You know, Shaq can fit in a Kia. How, I don't know. If that was a commercial he did, I still, so whatever. But anyway, the point being is that it's not as easy as people think. Oh, he's 6'11". He should dominate basketball. He's got 4.3 speed. He should dominate in football when he gets the ball. Or this kid should be stealing bases in baseball and so forth and so on. And this girl can throw like 80 miles an hour in softball. She should dominate. And it's just easy for people to say that because they have no clue what those, many of those people are talking about it, have no clue what those kids are going through. And the bottom line is the kids have to choose what's best for them. And they might upset a local coach, whether it's in their school, whether it's a traveling coach, whether it's a college coach, or whoever. They may even disappoint their parents. Whatever the case may be, they've got to choose their path because it is their life. And there are kids, I think, that do end up trying to please their parents all the time, or trying to please their coaches all the time, or trying to please the masses all the time, and they don't truly do what they really want to do. They aren't true to their selves. And I agree with you 110% that the kids, it is a burden off their shoulders when they make a decision where they're going to play. Well, first of all, it's a decision. I know for me, I was a really good basketball player. That was my sport, okay? And in tennis, I was good at tennis, all right? So, and it ended up being that tennis was my sport that I played in college instead of basketball because my senior year was a whole mess with our coach, head coach being fired after my junior year, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, it was a burden off my shoulders because I got letters and stuff from people, colleges, and not as many as Harlan Obiaha, and I didn't get Division I offers, but I got stuff from colleges about me going to school. I had all these things to look at. I could go visit these campuses, which you don't have to be an athlete to go visit campuses and find out whether you're going to go to school.
Exactly.
And I remember when I made my decision, I put together a plan. I wanted to go play tennis because I wanted to do something in sports, and basketball wasn't an option after my senior year. I kind of was burnt out from what happened. So then I played tennis, and it was all on me, and I liked that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and played tennis 2 years in college, but I knew all along I was going to play 2 years. I was going to transfer, and my plan was to go to Pittsburgh State. But I had my game plan finally figured out. It took a while to figure out that game plan. But once I figured out that game plan, do you know that I felt like I lost 50 pounds?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was a big weight off of my shoulders. Now imagine, now take what I just told you of my personal experience and multiply that by probably 1,000. For Harlan Obioha or anybody like him that is being sought after by everybody. I can't imagine how relieved they are. I can't imagine how much pressure they felt.
They go through during the process, right? Of just
and they have to
everybody.
Still, and they people still have to go to school. They have to go to school and get good grades. They got to still go play ball at high school level and, you know, try to win state titles and play well. They still got to do all that while this is happening.
Yeah, and this is not pressure from mom and dad.
No.
This is not pressure from people in Hoxie.
No.
This is not pressure from those coaches that are just those coaches that are recruiting him. It's people in Wichita, Kansas, that saw this guy's Twitter page, that saw this guy's highlights on a media outlet's Twitter or whatever, and they're, like, disappointed now that he's not going to play college football, probably. Like, they never met Harlan Obioha. They've never been – don't even know where Hoxie, Kansas is.
Right.
Never met the guy. Don't know what he's like. Don't know who he is.
Sure.
And they're mad, probably, that he's not going to go play Division I football because he could represent Kansas and small-town Kansas in Division I football. Why did he make the decision to not do that if he had all these offers? I guarantee you there's those people out there.
Of course
there is. And those are the people that put those – I think the real pressure on the shoulders of a kid that I'm like, why am I trying to make these people happy?
And if those kids are on social media, they see that.
Exactly.
So there's even more pressure.
And that's what I'm saying is it's like it's so magnified. And we were talking a little bit about that when we originally talked about this too, is with social media. It's so magnified. And it's like, why does a guy in Topeka or Wichita or even small town in
Why do they care about a guy they never met?
South Central Kansas, Southeast Kansas. I mean, they're mad that he's making this decision to better himself or to feel better in his own skin and whatever he's doing. That you're now mad that he's not playing Division I football because it could make your state look good. Because I know that's what the thought process is for those people. And it's like, well, no, you don't know Harlan Obioha. You've never been to Hoxie. You don't know anything about it. And it's just like, just let the kid make a decision.
A lot of those people don't know if the kid is black or white. They don't know if he's tall or short. And they don't know how to pronounce his name. But they can tell him what he's supposed to do with the rest
definitely
of
don't
his
know
life.
How to pronounce
Isn't
his
that
name.
Gutsy or cowardly? Whatever you want to look at. Yeah, I think that's
a
great point.
So that's a lot of pressure that you could hear everything in his voice about the whole process when you were interviewing him on Saturday.
That was one of the interviews. Done lots of interviews, you and I, on the sideline and through the years and during the weeks. And that one really, I wish I had more time because you only had a little bit of time. I really wish I had more time to interview him.
And
about
he was
that.
Able to make it personal.
Yes, he did.
And a lot of those kids are caught up on the moment. Their brain's processing different because they're playing a game too.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to make that so personal.
Very thoughtful.
And it was outstanding.
It was. It was. In fact, I want to go back and listen to that here pretty soon after we sign off. It was good. So it was a great day. I mean, it was a great day, and the kids did a wonderful job. The coaches were fantastic. The week was great. The only complaint was there was humid and hot, but it's the middle of June,
it is what it is. You're going to get a little bit of that.
The players did a great job, and the players had a blast, and you know, I was talking about the decals that they have on all their helmets. They wear their school helmets, and then the decals are shared throughout the week. That shows kind of the brotherhood, in my opinion. And then a big thanks to, you know, Dave Dubert. He had to leave for a wedding, but he helped set all this up, of course, the chairman. And then Eric Bergs, Kelly Kimmer, and others kind of grabbed the baton. We had, you know, Dave Dreyer did a great job with the PA, as he always does. And he had to announce about 1,000 names because he had announced all the names of the kids that didn't play last year. The officials thanked them so much. It was a hot day out there for them to be in, you know, the pants and the black and, you know, that draws the heat. And those guys did a wonderful job and no ejections, which is awesome.
Yep.
And no players even got to the point where officials had to think about it. I didn't think there was any controversial calls in this game either.
No.
They did a wonderful job. A lot of volunteers on the chain crew, some young kids that did a really good job. And then, of course, all the organizations, and we've mentioned them. And, you know, I don't even want to go through all the organizations and individuals beyond what I just did because I don't want to leave too many people out.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
You know who you are. If you're a part of the Ant-Man All-Star Games, whether it was during the week, with practices and at the college, or whether you were at the movie theater helping out, or at the pep rally on Friday, which was a blast, by the way. Who knew that we'd have a folding chair broken and turn into an autographed item that Trey Barrientos did? That was hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it. We had the balloon relay race with those kids, and, man, that was funny to watch. Tug of War was pretty cool, too. We did Family Feud. We had a lot of fun, and that hour went very quickly. So thanks to everybody making the pep rally work with the Beloit Area Chamber of Commerce. Mitchell County Convention and Tourism did a great job, along with the Chamber, for that and also for the Friday Night Lights and the highlight reel that Jason Gilley put together, I heard was outstanding again. So it takes a team. It takes a village, as many people say, to put on an event like that. There are people that believe that, you know, you just show up and it happens. It doesn't. If you've ever been a volunteer, you'll understand that. For anybody out there who's never volunteered for anything or have never been a part of a bigger event, I highly encourage you to do it. Because if you haven't, you don't understand. You really don't. Mm-hmm. But if you do, you do understand. And I think everybody should volunteer in one way or another in some form. Because once you do, I'm not saying you have to volunteer for everything. We all have things we got to do in our lives. I get it. But if you can volunteer, whether it's eight-man pep rally, eight-man all-star game, whether it's practices, whether it's you're volunteering Meals on Wheels, whatever it might be, just volunteer and you'll get a better idea what things happen. Because it's easy from the outside to be critical. It's easy from the outside looking in, you know, like we just talked about with players. Well, how could he decide to play basketball when he's 6'11", could dominate in football? Well, 6'11", he can dominate in basketball too.
Yeah.
So he's good at two sports. He gets his choice. He can't do both. So just keep all that in mind, because it takes a lot of work. A lot of work to put on an event like the 8-Man All-Star Games, and Beloit's done it for 36 years, and we look forward to year 37 next year.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Something that isn't fantastic, Royals baseball. The Royals went 1-6 this week on the West Coast. They were swept by the Angels, lost 3-4 to Oakland. They've lost 8 of their last 9. They are a roller coaster of a baseball team. They were outscored 51-24. That's not good on their trip, but Andrew Benintendi hit a home run.
Benintendi hits it well to left field and deep. Pinder is back. He's at the wall, and it's gone. And that's another opposite field home run for Andrew Benintendi. And it is 3-2 in the third.
Royals left 8 men on base. They're 1-for-9 with runners in scoring position Sunday. They've now hit 162, 7-for-43 with runners in scoring position on the road trip over the 7 games. And we've talked about it before. It's pretty simple. That if the Royals' offense is really going to click, Jorge Soler and Hunter Dozier got to figure things out. Soler's hitting 178, Dozier's hitting 160, and these are guys supposed to be power bats, and they're making some good money. Those guys, they know they got to step it up. I know it's not easy to hit a baseball. It's easy for me to say they got to step it up. I can't hit a baseball. Well, I can, but it's usually coach pitch I could hit it. But, you know, they're paying a lot of money. They're supposed to be doing better. They know that. They're working on it. I'm sure they're frustrated, and they feel the pressure. Maybe they're pressing too much. But there's no question that the Royals' offense is being held back if those two are going to struggle. Here's Mike Matheny on the struggles, not only of Dozier and Soler, but when the Royals have runners in scoring position, you got to score.
Yeah, I think we still left some money on the table there and some opportunities to do something there in the second. It was good to see Nicky put together a really good at-bat and at least get one. We've talked about that a number of times, but you know, we're still looking for that big hit, that one that allows us to put a little space. And then we need to shut down right after that, too. And unfortunately, gave up a couple more after we did get one. But, just one of those that the big hit kind of eluded us.
So that's Mike Matheny, manager of the Royals. A lot of missed opportunities on offense. The other thing that is very important for the Royals is they have to get good starting pitching, and there is absolutely a direct correlation, without a doubt. When the Royals have been winning, their starting pitching has been good, and when they've been losing, it's not been good at all. And this road trip was not good. The Royals saw three of their top picks from the 2018 draft, Brady Singer, Jackson Cowher, and Chris Bubich, on the mound this weekend in Oakland. Singer gave the Royals a chance to win Friday, allowed 3 runs in 6 innings, but Cowher couldn't get out of the second inning in both of his starts. He's looking like Daniel Lynch the second, unfortunately. Yeah. And Chris Bubich, who pitched very, very well the first 3 or 4 starts, he's now allowing a ton of homers. Bubich has allowed 7 home runs and 8 2/3 over his last 2 starts. Cowher, his issue was command. Bubich's issue on Sunday was location. He allowed 5 runs and 4 2/3. The A's took advantage of middle fastballs and changeups. He's been hanging his changeup, and he gave up 3 homers yesterday, 4 homers a previous start. Before this week, Bubich hadn't allowed a home run on his changeup all season. He's now allowed 6 just on his changeup. So you got Bubich, you've got Singer, you got Cowher. I think 2 of those 3, if not all 3, are going to be a part of this this team in the future down the line. Bubic might become more of a reliever, but Cowher and Singer, you know, those are guys that the Royals are hoping are going to be starters and part of the team that's going to lead them back to the World Series. And the early returns, you know, Singer's been kind of mixed this year. He's got the stuff. He's the best of them so far. But Cowher, you know, a little disappointed. I thought he'd pitch better his second time out than his first time. So there are growing pains that the Royals are experiencing with those young starters. I just hope they don't bring them up too soon and they ruin their confidence. That is a concern. But if they don't get better starting pitching, then they're not going anywhere. And we can put all the blame on the offense if you want. You can blame Jorge Soler and Hunter Dozier all you want. But it's simple. If your starting pitching can't get through five innings, six innings, and you're going to be out early in a game like Cowher and Lynch was for a few starts, and now Cowher and Bubic can't get through the fifth yesterday, that puts a strain. The Royals had 14 games in 14 days. Thank God Carlos Hernandez and Ronald Bolaños have come up, and when they bring them up to eat some innings, because without those guys, this bullpen would be completely dead in the water with dead arms. So the Royals, obviously, the pitching's got to be better, and especially the starting pitching, because the bullpen, honestly, recently hasn't been that bad despite having to pitch a lot. So the Royals back in action tonight. They start a three-game set with the Tigers. 7-10 first pitch at the K. Brad Keller 6-5 despite an ERA of almost 6. Let's turn to Chiefs football for just a quick moment. Couple of things here. Le'Veon Bell, former Chief, said over the weekend, "I'll never play for Andy Reid again. I'd retire first." That was in response to somebody on Twitter talking with him about, you know, hey, you're still a free agent. You should re-sign with Kansas City. I would have said no, but that's what one fan said to him. And he basically said, no, I'll never play for Andy Reid again. I'd retire first. He later didn't necessarily retract those comments, but he did say yesterday, I shouldn't have put that on social media. I shouldn't respond to that quickly. And he did say, I love my time in Kansas City. It was the closest locker room I've ever been a part of. He had many, many positive things to say, but he did not back off his comment because he said, that's how I feel in regards to Andy Reid. I don't know if Andy Reid promised him something. I don't know if he read between the lines the wrong way, Le'Veon Bell. I don't know if he's bitter because he didn't get a play in the Super Bowl. He was inactive for the AFC title game. Bell was. Mm-hmm. The Super Bowl, he didn't play at all. Remind me of LeSean McCoy the year before. Le'Veon Bell did not have the impact that I thought he could have had on this team, which I don't know if that's because he's washed up. I don't know if it's because he just, you know, didn't figure out the offense, maybe too complicated for him. I don't know. Or if Andy Reid just felt more comfortable with Clyde Edwards-Helaire, a rookie, and also with Darrell Williams, who came on there at the end. But the bottom line is Le'Veon Bell in the Chiefs, it was a luxury for the Chiefs to have him. It didn't cost them anything, I don't think, the Chiefs, you know, other than a little bit of money. And they tried it. It didn't really work. It was a lot of reward and for a low risk. And Le'Veon Bell can be upset all he wants, in my opinion. He doesn't like Andy Reid, great. And he says, I'll never play Andy Reid again. I'm guessing Andy Reid would say, I'm really not interested in you playing for me again. So, hey, touche, is what I'd say there. The other thing is, Travis Kelce was in Cleveland, Ohio, playing a celebrity softball game. He is from Cleveland, and he's from Ohio. And he played for Cincinnati, of course, in college. And Baker Mayfield was at the celebrity softball game as well, quarterback of the Browns. And Travis Kelce said that the Browns and the Chiefs are basically neck and neck. He goes, he expects a lot of great battles between the two. Of course, the playoff game last year came down to Chad Henne making a pass on fourth down and one after he had to run for 11 on what was it, a third and 12 or something like that. And so I get the point. You know, this is where people forget things. Well, the Browns almost beat the Chiefs. You know, the Browns are right there neck and neck. And it's nice of Kelce to say that, because I think deep down he doesn't believe what he just said. Because Mahomes got hurt in the third quarter of that game. The Chiefs were rolling 22-3. If Mahomes doesn't get hurt in that game, I don't think that comes down to Chad Henne having to make a play on fourth and one. I think it's pretty simple. It isn't as close. It might even turn into a blowout. So let's not jump too far ahead. Now, I think the Browns are a contender. Don't get me wrong. I think they are a contender. I think the Ravens are still a contender. I think the Bills are the biggest contender to the Chiefs. Listen, if Aaron Rodgers goes and plays for Denver or Oakland, and that obviously makes them a contender, I might be leaving somebody out. But, Miami could be a contender, I think. It depends on Tua, because I think that's the key for the Dolphins. But I think the Patriots can be back up and battling, especially if Mac Jones ends up being the real deal as a quarterback, that I think at some point the rookie will get the play, and that could change everything for the Patriots. But really, the Bills and the Browns and the Ravens, to me, I don't know if there's anybody else. Those are the three that I think are the biggest threats to the Chiefs, and I don't really buy the Ravens yet because the Chiefs have had their number. I do buy the Browns if Baker plays well. They got a good running game. They made some really nice additions, the Browns did this year. They get Odell Beckham back if he's not a cancer.
Yeah.
I think the Browns, you know, the Browns very well could be. Everybody's talking about the Bills being the biggest threat to the Chiefs. It may very well be the Cleveland Browns. And so Kelce might not be far off with his comments. But to say they're neck and neck, I totally disagree. Because his boy Mahomes, one of his best friends, was hurt in the third quarter of that game. So when he was tackled awkwardly. So I'm not completely buying that the Browns are at the Chiefs level. So when Kelce says neck and neck, I take that as he says they're at the Chiefs level. No, they're not. Not yet. They could be. I'm not saying they can't be. But I'm not going to put them quite there yet.
No. I'm with you on that one for sure.
It was nice of Travis to say
that.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. Gotta
he's also in Ohio. The hometown boys, is, yes, you know, exactly.
You know, when you're from the Cleveland Heights area, I mean, you gotta please them and appease them, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
Say the right things around Absolutely. Those hometown guys.
Hey, a couple of nuggets. I'll go back to the 8-man All-Star games. I meant to mention this. Trey Berrientos was a third of his family to play in the game. Mm-hmm. Cale Lindsey was the third of his family to play in the game. And then Blake and Braden Perez were number two and number three in their family because mm-hmm. Eric played in it in 2013. There might be some other combinations that we're not aware of.
And I usually go through all that, mm-hmm. but I ran out of time to find out all the connections with them. Sure. I knew there were some Lindsays that played, too, from South Central in the past. I didn't remember how many of them, though.
I don't know if it was Cale Lindsey's mom or relative at the pep rally came up to me after the game or after the pep rally, and she said, hey, did you know that Cale is a third? And I said, no, I didn't know that. I knew the Berrientos, they had a third, and Perez, of course, is second and third. And she said, and then they have another one coming up. She said 2027. So I got to keep that in my head. You know, if I'm still here, God willing, 2027, there's a Lindsay. I'm going to be like, I remember when that lady told me about that kid back when the kid was 11 years old.
Yep.
2027. You know, or when he's 12. He's 12 now. Kind of interesting. That might be the first fourth person from a family.
Because
you got the Duberts.
Kids and siblings. There's four Duberts that have played, but Dave's dad and then three sons. So there's four in the family that have played. But they've only got three kids.
You mean Dave played?
Yeah, that's what I said. Dave's dad that has played. Dave is the dad that played in the game. Is how I meant to say that.
You're saying Dave's dad.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no
Dave is the dad. I meant to add another word in there. Dave is the dad.
I didn't know Grandpa played in the game.
Dave is the dad that played in the game, and then the three kids played. So they've got four in the family that have played.
They do.
But obviously, only three boys. So yeah, like we've said before.
If Lauren
wanted to do it, she could probably strap him on and play in the game too. But that would be interesting. I did have people asking me how many times like three brothers have played in the game, and mm-hmm. I was like, I just don't know. My records don't go back any more than when we started doing the games, as far as that's concerned, to have all that information right now.
Yeah, and there is like a whole rundown of the rosters that the program has, but you don't know if they're cousins or if mm-hmm. they're brothers. Like there's been lots of Junimans that have been involved, obviously two the other day mm-hmm. on the same team. Okay, we shift to tennis, then we'll get the NBA NHL playoffs. Novak Djokovic, man, down two sets to none, comes back and wins the French Open.
And second match of Djokovic. Trois matchs à deux.
Number 19 for Novak. But he's never done this. An 0-2 comeback for his second French Open victory.
That completes the second career Grand Slam for Novak Djokovic. You know, remember Sampras couldn't win on clay? Mm-hmm. I guess he got a career Grand Slam, if I remember, but Sampras never could. It's super impressive. He's down two sets to none. He's 34 against, can you help me on the pronunciation, the guy he went up against?
Tsitsipas,
who is 22. And, I mean, he had every right to think it's not his day. He won a great semifinal in four sets over Rafael Nadal. Nadal rarely ever loses on clay, so that was a big deal. So Djokovic now has 19 Grand Slam titles, and if he didn't, you know, hit a ball at a lines judge or whatever at the U.S. Open, he might already have 20. Mm-hmm. Here's the crazy thing is that this is pretty amazing. Roger Federer is focusing on Wimbledon because that's his probably best chance to win his next major. He pulled out of this tournament after three wins in three rounds and then pulled out because he wanted to rest up, I guess, for Wimbledon. Nadal, of course, can win on grass. We know he has before. And, of course, Novak is probably him and Federer are probably better suited for grass than Nadal, though Nadal's done fine there. But this is an interesting thing. Nadal has 20 Grand Slam titles. Federer has 20 Grand Slam titles. And Novak Djokovic has 19. And Novak is a few years younger than Federer and Nadal. Mm-hmm. And so Novak, Wimbledon could, this sounds pretty crazy to say, But there are some younger guys that are getting close. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the kid that you just mentioned that I can't pronounce. Team's got a chance. He's a younger guy that has been in a major. Medvedev's another. And there's a few others that are up and coming. And, of course, Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic aren't getting any younger. So this Wimbledon coming up at the All England's Club here very soon could honestly determine who's the greatest player of all time. Because you usually want to judge it on championships, which is funny because they always say Jordan is better than LeBron, the people on Jordan's side. Jordan's better than LeBron because Jordan has 6 titles, LeBron has 4. And then Bill Russell's like, hold my beer. Because Bill Russell has many more titles than Michael Jordan. So that doesn't, to me, I don't think the amount of titles should mean you're automatically the greatest of all time. However, in tennis, I think it pretty much should because it's an individual sport. Mm-hmm. And the Grand Slams are the important thing. You know, if you win tons of tournaments, but you don't win nearly as many Grand Slams, how are you the greatest? The greatest is the big moments, the big time. The U.S. Open, the Australian Open, the French Open, and Wimbledon. Now, I will say Nadal, for me, I tend to put Federer and Novak above Nadal, and here's why. Not because I don't think Nadal's a great player, and Nadal, I believe, has won on every surface. He's got the career Grand Slam.
Yeah.
But he has a ton of them on clay. Whereas Federer and Djokovic are spread out a little bit more, okay? So I tend to lean towards those two as the greatest of all time. That, and then Nadal's obviously younger, so he beat Federer in some places where he's younger. Although you could say Novak took advantage of being a little bit younger against Nadal here recently,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But the bottom line is this. Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal have 20 Grand Slam titles, and Novak Djokovic has 19. This upcoming Wimbledon, if Novak gets his 20th, he's going to be the greatest player of all time because he's going to get – well, first of all, even if he's at 20, I think, you know, you could say it's a 3-way tie, whatever. But Novak's got a better chance of winning titles after Wimbledon. I think this is Federer's last and best chance to win a major in his career is the upcoming Wimbledon. That would get him to 21 if he could get it, and that might be enough to hold – Novak would be stuck at 19. And if Nadal can't, you know, go – he has health issues sometimes. If Nadal can't get after it next year, and even if he does win the French, well, then Nadal would have 21 again, I guess. But – I think this Wimbledon could very well – if Novak gets 20, then he's going to be the guy. But if Nadal or Federer can get 21, I don't know. I don't know if Novak will get 2 more after that. I think he can, but he's also 34, and he's had some injuries. So the upcoming Wimbledon could very well make it a 3-way tie, or it could be Federer or Nadal taking the clear-cut lead, or it'll just stay the way it is, and some guy we don't talk about is going to win Wimbledon.
I would not be surprised, actually, if somebody else wins it out of those, not one of those three at Wimbledon.
Which is rare nowadays for anyone outside of those three to win a major.
Yeah,
but.
And, man, Fed's back in whatever his version of healthy is at the age of 40.
Right.
But I don't feel like he's going to get it done this year
at
Wimbledon.
So I think Federer is done winning.
And I don't think Nadal is going to do it. So it's going to be Djokovic, I feel like, or one of the young guns.
I think you're right. I'd love to see Federer maybe win one more. I'd be okay with that.
I would absolutely love to see Federer win at least one more.
Yeah, but I think grass the best chance.
If he wins another one, he's not going to win more than one more. I think
and that would add to his legacy. He'd be the oldest guy of those three to win a major, and that'd be his 21st. I guess see how old Roger Federer is, but that would add to the legacy of him. Like at the age of 39 years of age, he'd be 39 at Wimbledon. He is 39 now.
Yeah.
He turns 40 on August 8th.
I was going to say, I know it's new. Yeah. It was sometime here.
So to be 39 or 40 and win a major, and he is older than Nadal and Djokovic, like 5 years over Djokovic, that would add to his legacy and get his 21st.
Absolutely. And I would not be honestly surprised if he would go out and win Wimbledon and just be like, all right, we're good.
Oh, I agree with
you. I'm going to call it.
I agree with you.
In fact, I'm going to go out on top. Now, if he doesn't do that, I think he'll play in the U.S. Open and maybe try one more time in this calendar year. And then if it doesn't work, I honestly wouldn't be surprised to see, I'm going to call it a career at 40, you know, once the U.S. Open's done.
I agree with you. I think he'll play – if he wins or loses Wimbledon, if he's healthy, he'll play the U.S. Open. Then he'll be – I think he might retire, especially if he wins one of them.
Yeah.
You're right. Nadal's 35, by the way. He just turned 35. Djokovic is 34. And then Federer is 39, going to be 40. So that's 5-year difference. So that adds to the legacy. If Federer could win a major near the age of 40 against guys like Nadal and Djokovic, who are 5 years younger, or in the case of the kid that I can't pronounce again, Spispibist or whatever his name is, he's 22. I mean, Federer is old enough to be his dad.
Yeah.
Barely, but there's 17, 18-year-olds that had kids
definitely
before.
Yeah, he's definitely old enough.
Okay, the NBA playoffs. Speaking of age... Chris Paul is ageless.
Got the screen. Paul lets it rip. Chris Paul. 35 for Paul. Oh, and a steal. Booker puts it up. Knocked away. Bridges got the ball. Into it. Oh, and he covers it in.
That's it. Rebound. This will do it.
Suns have swept the Denver Nuggets. The Suns are going to the conference finals.
I tell you, the Suns are so fun to watch. I love watching them play. I've always been a fan of Chris Paul. I think my lucky stars, I had a chance, him and my son, to watch him play right before COVID struck at OKC a year and a half ago when he was a member of the Thunder, because he scored 30 points, and I bet 20 were from 15, 16 feet. The mid-range game is a lost art in NBA, and he has perfected it. And he's so good at getting his team set up. He is the consummate point guard. He's a great leader. He's a great passer. He's a very good shooter. He's 90-some percent at the line. He can hit the three if he needs to, but the mid-range game, he's perfected. He mentioned it yesterday in the post-game interview that once you had this drop-two coverage that they have in the NBA when he was with the Clippers so many years ago, he said, you know what, I decided to perfect the mid-range game. When everybody is zigging, he's zagging. I love it. And people said he was done a few years ago. They were wrong. And last night, at the age of 36, he had 37 points, and that's the most points he's scored, they said, in 3 years. He did score 30 when we were there, when they played the Blazers about a year and a half ago, and we got to also watch Dame Lillard score 30-some, and it was kind of an off night for Dame, to be honest with you. That was so much fun to watch those two go at it, and so we're very fortunate to have been at that game. But Chris Paul is just awesome. He makes everybody better around him. Booker's better. Ayton's better. Bridges is playing great. And the Suns win last night, 125-118, the sweep, the series against the Nuggets in Denver. Michael Porter Jr. came through and played pretty well to give him a chance. But Jokic got ejected in the third quarter, took a big-time swipe at the ball, and nailed Payne in the face. And then Jokic later, you know, was making sure he was okay. Jokic was just frustrated, and that got him ejected. And based on the letter of the rules, that was a flagrant too. And he was thrown out of the game. And it's unfortunate because he's had a great year. I don't think any MVP has ever been thrown out of his last game of a season. I would bet there hasn't happened. And so the Nuggets got swept, and now the Suns will get a week off to rest and get ready for the winner of the Clipper Jazz series. And then in the East, you know, I said it, and remember, I can play back the tape. I remember exactly what I said, that the Nets went up 2-0 over the Bucks, and they blew them out in game two. And I said the Bucks' best chance to win a game is game three. They get game three. The Nets are going to win the next two. It's going to be over in five. But I did say the Bucks' only chance to win this series is if two of the big three get hurt. Harden's out. So the Bucks need Irving or Durant to get hurt. And if one of those two gets hurt, now it's one superstar versus one superstar. The playing field is level, and then the Bucks have a chance. That's what I said. Mm-hmm. That's the only way the Bucks are going to win the series is if the Nets had one more major injury. And bingo, here it is yesterday. Kyrie Irving turned his ankle. It did not look good. He was on crutches. He was in a boot. I don't know if he's going to play tomorrow night in game five. I doubt it. Mm-hmm. And if he does, I don't think he's going to be that effective. Harden is not ready to come back. It would be a mistake to put him out there because he's nursing the hamstring. Steve Nash said they're not going to rush him. Joe Harris is going to have to play big. Landry Shamet off the bench. Blake Griffin maybe has an injury, they said now, too. So you got these older stars that, you know, breaking down. And so the Nets, you know, can they win game five? Yes, absolutely. But Durant is the guy. P.J. Tucker did a heck of a job against him yesterday. And Durant isn't used to not having Robin to his Batman.
Yeah, at least somebody. Yeah.
Think about that. Like at OKC, he had Harden and he had Westbrook. And he went to Golden State and he had Thompson and Green and Curry. He goes to New Jersey or Brooklyn and he has Kyrie or Harden. Now, granted, they only played 7 or 8 games together, all three of them. But when Durant's played, he's at least had one of them with him. Now he's got to do it, I don't want to say all by himself, but he's going to have to score probably 40 for them to have a chance. And I don't see where the Nets are going to get enough offense. I agree with Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley. I don't know if they're going to get enough offense, even if Durant goes nuts, without Irving and Harden. And so the series has changed because of health. And that's what we said before the playoffs began, that the Lakers and Nets probably should be in the NBA Finals. But the Lakers have injury problems with LeBron throughout the year and then AD. Guess what happened? They're up 2-1 early in the second at halftime. It's the Lakers-Suns. They're in a tight game in game 4 at Staples. Anthony Davis got hurt late in the second quarter, and he did not return. Tried to come back in the last game of the series and, of course, couldn't go. And that really determined the series. If AD is perfectly healthy and LeBron's healthy, I don't know if the Suns win that series. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a 50-50 thing. But there's no question that they weren't going to win the series with a guy that had a horrible groin injury in AD. So that determined the Lakers' fate was their health. And we also said before the playoffs, the Nets, the only thing that's going to keep the Nets out of the NBA Finals is going to be injuries. And here we are. Harden, 43 seconds in to game one against the Bucks, pulled the hammy or strained the hammy. He's out. That's an injury that can last a while. And then the ankle can, too. And now Kyrie Irving, I mean, they're going to get the best medical treatment in the world, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
But Kyrie Irving, I don't know how effective. Like, he might play tomorrow night. I don't know how effective he's going to be. They don't have a facilitator. And Durant's not really a facilitator. He's a scorer. Irving can be a facilitator. Harden, he is their facilitator this year with the Nets. He's taken a back seat. The Nets are in big-time trouble. I'm not going to say the Nets are going to lose this series. I'm not right now. I'm not going to say the Nets are going to lose tomorrow night. But things are certainly going the direction of the Bucks. And if you're Giannis and you're the Bucks and you've been tired of this whole monkey on your back and you can't get through and make things happen in the playoffs, you have to take advantage. You have to win tomorrow night. You have to take down the Nets when they are a wounded animal. And if you do not, then you allow the Nets then to win game five, then all the pressure on game six, and then game seven, who knows? Maybe Harden or Irving can come back and make some kind of contribution. You've got to hit them now. You've got to beat them tomorrow. You beat them tomorrow, then you're up 3-2. You go to Milwaukee, a chance to close it, and the Bucks have won like 10, 12, 15 games in a row at home. They're a different team at home, like most teams are. They shoot the three better at home. And now you got Holiday playing well. Middleton's really coming around. They got Lopez playing well. Tucker's playing great defense on Durant. I mean, this series has shifted. But the reason this series has shifted, quite honestly, to me, is pretty simply injuries. It's that. You may say that takes away from the Bucks. Listen, when only two of the stars were healthy, then that's won by, we're up by 49 points in game two. So in game three, the Nets should have won. Joe Harris was 1-for-11 from the floor. Durant struggled from the floor. Irving struggled from the floor. And the Bucks barely won. And the Nets didn't play well at all. So you're thinking game four, like I was, the Nets are going to win. And if Kyrie doesn't get hurt, I believe they would have won. He got hurt, changes everything, because now you can't make the adjustment. Your game plan's all based on having Irving and Durant on the floor. This is why I won't write off the Nets. Game five tomorrow night, we're going to see how good Steve Nash is as a coach. And we're going to maybe see an unbelievable performance for Kevin Durant. I'm prepared for him to go nuts. And I'm also prepared for him to struggle with P.J. Tucker, not have a second score. But tomorrow night, the Nets are going to at least have a game plan, knowing they're not going to have Irving or Harden. I would imagine they won't have either. They're going to go in assuming that they're not going to have those guys. They will have a different game plan. But when what happens is when you're in the NFL, well, look at what the Chiefs did. Their game plan completely changed in the AFC playoffs, which we referred to earlier against the Browns, when Mahomes got hurt. Didn't their game plan change? Their play calling had to change because Chad Henne's not Patrick Mahomes. So during the middle of a game, it's hard to make those adjustments because your whole game plan all week long for football or basketball, whatever, is you're going with your starters. These are the guys you have. This is the game plan you put together. When one of those guys goes out and suddenly early in the game or something, it changes everything. But then if you have time to prepare and have a little bit more time to adjust without Irving or Harden, the Nets could come up with a much better game plan and at home tomorrow night. I go back to the Chiefs. Why was Matt Moore successful winning a big game for the Chiefs a couple years ago when Mahomes was hurt? Because they were able to get him prepared all week long. They knew Mahomes was out. Whereas you honestly are better off knowing your star is out than hoping that he's going to play somehow. You're better off just knowing if he's going to play or not play and move on. And the Nets would be better off knowing right now, is Kyrie going to play or not? I think the Nets got to approach it as he's not going to play, Harden's not going to play, and if somehow Irving does play, that's extra credit. That's bonus. We'll take it. But we're not counting on it. So I'm not going to write off the Nets quite yet. The Bucks still got to prove to me that they got to win a game on the road. The Bucks, this is your opportunity, and you better not squander it, because you lose tomorrow night, you probably still going to lose the series, even if the Nets don't have a full complement of players.
Yeah. You do. You got to go out there and prove it here with the Bucks to make sure you take advantage of that opportunity that you might have as well to only have to face Kevin Durant out of those three. So you've got to have the right game plan going in and understand that at some point I'm going to have to win on the road here to make sure I can get this done. And you have to have that mindset and have to be really taking advantage of your opportunity right now, or else you regret it as you move forward.
Listen, the Bucks, you got to win one on the road somewhere. I'd rather win game five and close it in six. Yeah. That's for sure. Giannis, 34 points, 12 rebounds yesterday. Shot well from the floor, 14-26. Durant, 9 of 25. 28 points, 13 rebounds. Bucks won 107-96. That best of seven between the Nets. Bucks tied 2-2 game five tomorrow night in Brooklyn. As we mentioned, the Suns, Booker at 34 points, 37 for Chris Paul as the Suns sweep the Nuggets 125 to 118. Your games tonight on this Monday evening, June the 14th. It's the Hawks and the Sixers. I think the Hawks are in trouble. I think I said it after game one that the Sixers made some adjustments. They figured something out to slow down the Hawks, and I didn't even care going to game two if the Sixers lost game two, because I think the Sixers, as long as Embiid is healthy enough to play, I think they have the advantage. And I the Hawks may win tonight game four. They may. I don't know. I will say this. I wouldn't be surprised if the Sixers run the course here and go four straight. Wouldn't be surprised at all. And then the Clippers and the Jazz could be an unbelievable series. Kawhi and Paul George played great the last game. They're going to have to play great again tonight, because they're going to get a better effort from the Jazz tonight in game four than they get in game three. Donovan Mitchell versus Leonard and George, that series could go the distance. Clippers-Jazz tonight, 9 o'clock. So both those games are on TNT. NHL playoffs, Islanders beat the Lightning last night 2-1. That series, Islanders lead. The Eastern Conference Finals 1-0. Western Conference Finals begins tonight. Yep, Western Conference Finals, and you're stuck on Sports Network on NBC. You don't even get the regular broadcast channel for the Western Conference Finals. It is Montreal versus Vegas in Vegas. Whoa, baby. It's going to be a great atmosphere tonight. Game one of the Western Conference Finals between the Canadiens and the Golden Knights. Let's see. Anything else to add before we let people go? Really scary moment. A soccer player that collapsed and was in cardiac arrest, and they revived him and brought him back from the dead, basically. An amazing story. The Erickson guy. I don't have the full name here in front of me.
Yeah, I don't have all the details either. I saw that.
But that's just absolutely, thank God, there were the people there to save him. You know, I know we had a young man at Beloit. Thank God they had the stuff and the people did the right thing to save his life, or he would have passed away. And then there are people that pass away don't have that luxury or have the things nearby or the right people around them to
happen by yourself.
It could happen when you're by yourself. Yeah.
Secluded and not around anybody. And
You know, you sometimes just got to believe in the higher power, and when your time is over, your time is over. Mm-hmm. But apparently the soccer player, Erickson, I believe, his time is not over. Christian Erickson, his name, a Danish soccer player, basically was dead and was brought back to life. Pretty amazing story. Thank your lucky stars. Nothing is guaranteed, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing is guaranteed. Have a great day. Hope you enjoyed it. All that recap and coverage is there, 8manallstars.com.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.